Captured on film. On the one side, it's a tragedy that I have made only 2 feature films in 30 years, the Syrian director Osama Mohammed remarked. Yet from the other side, I see it as a miracle. It was April 2006. We were sitting in the Rauda Cafe, the center of the modest intellectual life of Damascus, where television stars, screenwriters, and poets gathered for leisurely mid-morning chats. The clatter of backgammon boards and the smell of apple-flavored tobacco from shisha pipes filled the room. A man in a black jacket at the next table, who appeared to be reading a magazine, occasionally leaned toward our conversation. In Syria, we have this huge army of secret police and a complete absence of legal protections, Mohammed said in a quiet, angry voice. You can go to jail for 35 years, and nobody will ask about you. He was 52 and broad-chested, with an unruly beard and wiry gray hair streaming down his back. His eyes were the same color as his habitual unsmoked cigar. People here have a sense of the balance of forces. They realize they are not strong enough to resist, he cautioned. In Syria, what we keep inside our imagination, what we don't tell, that is the main reality. Nearly every Middle Eastern country is governed by an authoritarian regime, but that hasn't kept many of those countries, notably Iran and Egypt, from developing surprisingly lively cinematic traditions. In a quarrelsome, voluble region, Syria is a strangely muted place. I wondered if by examining Syrian movies and talking to Syrian filmmakers, I could glimpse this closely guarded inner world. Mohammed's films, Stars in Broad Daylight, 1988, and Sacrifices, 2002, are merciless indictments of the Ba'athist dictatorship that has controlled Syria since 1963, when it came to power in a military coup. Both movies received international acclaim, although they were banned at home. Many foreign critics have portrayed Mohammed and other Syrian directors as symbols of artistic victimization, but he defiantly rejects that role. Do you want me to play the hero? He asked. Do you want me to repeat 200 times each day that my films are forbidden? This is my society. I belong to this world. I am not a victim. Yet a look around the Rauda Cafe suggests that the creative class in Syria has a lot of time on its hands. One writer I met has a job counting the city's street lamps. Most of the country's filmmakers, including Mohammed, are employees of the National Film Organization, which manages the production of all Syrian films. Mohammed is paid $250 a month, which is the average government wage. This salary allows filmmakers to pay their rent and spend much of their day idling at the Rauda, which has the atmosphere of a perpetual brooding salon. The Syrian government and the filmmakers have developed an awkward dependency upon each other. Ibrahim Hamidi, the Damascus bureau chief for the pan-Arab newspaper Al-Hayat, says, "By permitting Osama Mohammed and others to make movies financed by the government, the regime is harming the filmmakers' credibility and also trying to contain them. The films get awards abroad, which is good PR for the regime. At the same time, Syrians aren't allowed to see the movies." While filmmakers have the opportunity to test the limits of government censorship, the regime acquires an intimate sense of the mood of the nation's intellectuals. "The people who rule Syria are not stupid," Hamidi said. "They play a very sophisticated game." In this stifled and paralyzed country, the one-sided interchange between the filmmakers and the Assad regime is practically the only political dialogue available. I have an obsession with facing authority, Muhammad said. This society is responsible for creating the dictatorship. It's in our culture, our way of believing and thinking. I am trying to expose the authority inside us and the shadow of political authority in front of our doors. Stars in Broad Daylight is perhaps the greatest film to come out of Syria. It explores the toxic effect of totalitarianism on ordinary Syrians, as seen through the internal battles of a dysfunctional family. The oldest of three children works for the phone company, where he casually listens in on telephone calls. Brutal, corrupt, and whimsical, he forces his siblings to become engaged to people they despise in order to expand his land holdings. He encourages his brother to savagely beat their sister's suitor, then makes his sister get involved with a member of the regime, who rapes her. Not coincidentally, the actor playing this monstrous character looks like Hafez al-Assad, the man who ruled Syria for nearly 30 years until his death in 2000. I asked Muhammad how the movie came to be made. Dictatorship is not like this monolith where everyone is the same, he explained. No, inside you find a lot of people who want to support you. Stars wouldn't exist without three or four Syrian cinematographers who read the script on behalf of the National Film Organization. At the time, the government wanted to film an innocuous script by a different director, but the cinematographers had repeatedly rejected it. Finally, they made a deal, Mohammed recalled. They said, "We will give you this film if you give us stars." While Mohammed was working on the script, his brother Ali, an electrical engineer, was imprisoned. Government officials had tricked him by inviting him and several university professors to share their views on reform, then locking them up. The authorities subsequently threatened to send Ali to a prison in Palmyra, a notorious torture chamber, if Mohammed did not tone down his script. Mohammed refused to make any changes. "My relationship with my brother is like this. To salute him, I will make my movie. That is how I support him." Ali was released after 4.5 years, just before Mohammed began shooting. During the filming, crew members began to get scared. "The game was to make love with the fear," Mohammed said. "It was, yes, let's put Hafez al-Assad inside my movie." He cast his fellow director, Abdulatif Abdulhamid, in the lead role, largely because of his unmistakable resemblance to Assad. I asked Mohammed how he got away with making such a defiant film. "When you live in a garden of corruption, you learn the skills of bluffing," he said. "Some of my colleagues came and said, 'If this is not a piece of great art, you are going to be fucked.' When I was shooting, I forgot about this. But one day, when I was stuck in traffic, I thought, 'My God, what am I doing?'" He thought that he might be jailed the moment he submitted the final cut. To his surprise, he was not. But his movie was put in cold storage. It took Mohammed 14 years to make his second project, Sacrifices, which portrays the breakdown of social relations under dictatorship. "It is the story of Syria," he told me. "A huge quantity of time has been lost by holding on to illusions, the illusions of heroism, religion, Arab nationalism, and by not dealing with the other. The other is not Israel. It is inside our homes. It is inside everybody." When the script was completed, Mohammed submitted it to the National Film Organization. The scenario, about a dying man with a large family whose members are all competing for his blessing, was lyrical but obscure, and laden with references that government officials found both mysterious and provocative. What, they demanded, was the meaning of the child who places birds inside bottles, or the baby who floats, like Moses, down a Syrian river in his bassinet? The film ends with a shot of a giant tree, just after a child crawls into a casket.
The tree is positive, right?
A member of the National Film Organization asked him.
It's the homeland, right?
No, Mohammed said.
The tree is the tree.
He certainly didn't make it easy for himself.
You want to know my opinion about Syrian politics, Mohammed told the committee.
Is it democracy?
Absolutely not.
Is it dictatorship?
Yes. But if you want this country to have a democracy after 100 years, then this is our work together, right now. So don't shit on my film.
One scene in particular troubled the director of the National Film Organization. 3 boys are taught how to slaughter a cow while reciting verses from the Quran.
All the West is attacking us, because for them we are killers and extremists, the director told Mohammed. You don't want to say that,
he asked Mohammed to cut the scene. Mohammed refused, claiming that violence was an essential part of the culture.
You can't be a man unless you learn to kill, he declared.
The scene represents the initiation of a new generation into the pathologies of Syrian life. The 2 men were at an impasse. Mohammed finally said,
I know a secret about you. When you were young, you jumped from one building to another to meet your girlfriend.
How do you know this?
The astonished bureaucrat asked.
Ask the man who jumped what he thinks. Does he like the script?
It's amazingly beautiful.
Please, follow yourself. Don't forget who you are.
Go,
the director of the National Film Organization said.
Do it.
4 years later, when Sacrifices was finally completed, Ba'ath Party officials demanded considerable cuts. Mohammed declined, even though he knew that the film would therefore not be shown in Syria. Mohammed's brother Ali happened to wander into the Rauda cafe while we were talking. I recognized him, a white-haired man with kind green eyes, because he appears in Sacrifices. In a startling scene, a pubescent boy is tied to a post after violating the fast during Ramadan. A Quran is tied into the knot of the rope. Ali enters and unties the rope. The image is deeply personal. Mohammed had told me that Ali was the first in his family to deny the authority of religion.
When I did that scene, Osama took me aside and asked me to push my anger,
Ali said.
So I told him a story. When I was in prison, someone came to take a 13-year-old boy to Palmyra prison. He was terrified. He held on to me and pleaded not to let them take him away. This shot is for that boy.
Sacrifices received enthusiastic reviews at its premiere at the 2002 Cannes Film Festival, although some viewers were put off by Mohammed's elliptical storytelling. Indeed, when I first saw Sacrifices, the references seemed so personal that I wondered if this is what happens when a director no longer expects to have an audience. He makes a film that is entirely for himself. Even Syrian intellectuals who have obtained the film on the underground DVD circuit were puzzled by some of the scenes, like the opening shot, which shows a naked boy being lowered into a cave to fetch a chicken, or the sequence in which a boy's pants burst into flames. Mohammed does not see the hermetic qualities of Sacrifices as a weakness. The kitchen of cinema here is full of poisonous materials, he told me, but we are lucky as filmmakers to work in this kitchen. Because there is no audience, at least we don't have to worry about the censorship imposed by commercialism. He paused, then said,
Even if there were an audience,
I would not change my ways.
A few blocks away from the Rauda Café is the Syrian Parliament building, with its requisite portraits of Hafez al-Assad and his son Bashar, who has run the country since his father's death. The Parliament happens to stand on the site of Syria's first movie theater, which burned down a month after it was constructed in 1916. Across the street is the Cham Palace, the only movie theater in the capital that shows current releases. When I went on a Thursday evening, there was a small audience of families with children to see Big Mama's House 2, the Martin Lawrence comedy. Damascus was once home to dozens of first-run theaters, but because movie-going draws people together in a communal experience, the Ba'athist regime considers it a dangerous habit. Starting in the 1980s, party thugs began disrupting film audiences. At the same time, the selection of movies officially offered became smaller and smaller, and the theaters, which were forbidden to raise ticket prices, deteriorated.
2 decades ago, there were 120 cinemas in Syria, one filmmaker told me. Now there are only 6 that are functioning.
As the country's cinemas fell into ruin, civil life withered, and Syrians increasingly stayed indoors. Osama Muhammad fondly recalls the time when Syrians went to the movies regularly. One of 9 children, Mohammed grew up in Latakia, a town on the Mediterranean coast.
Before 1963, people could see films the same year they were produced, he said.
When Spartacus, the 1960 Stanley Kubrick classic, came to town, he said,
I didn't have money to go to the cinema, so I would steal from my brother Ali and invite my friends. Ali discovered this, and he brought a big stick and said, for every franc you steal, I will beat you once. I thought about it, and the next day I stole 3 francs. It was worth it.
Mohammed's father was a teacher at an elementary school where corporal punishment was commonplace.
But I am proud that my father didn't do that once, he said. At school, I was punished hundreds of times. Once I warned a teacher who was going to beat me. I was used to fighting on the streets. I said, if you strike me, I will hit you back. He didn't believe me, so I beat him up. I was 16.
Thrown out of Latakia's schools, Mohammed moved to Damascus to finish high school. The following year, one of his sisters, a doctor, called with some good news. She had saved the life of a government official who was in charge of giving foreign study scholarships to Syrian students.
Do you want to study in Russia? She asked Mohammed. Study what?
Medicine, she proposed.
No.
Engineering?
No.
Film? Mohammed remembered Spartacus and agreed. In 1974, he enrolled at the renowned Russian State Institute of Cinematography, or VGIK, which had produced many masters of cinema, including Andrei Tarkovsky and Vasily Shukshin. It would also be the incubator of the Syrian film industry. In Moscow, Mohammed met another Syrian, Mohammed Malas, who was in his final year at VGIK, and Malas introduced him to his mentor, Igor Talankin, who accepted Mohammed as a protege. A third Syrian, Abdulatif Abdulhamid, arrived in Moscow in 1975.
Upon returning home from Russia, the 3 Syrians attempted to create an indigenous cinema. In 1974, Malas, along with Omar Amirali, another young filmmaker, founded the Damascus Cinema Club. Amirali had already angered the regime by depicting the despair of rural peasants in everyday life in a Syrian village, a documentary that sharply undercut the government's boasts about agrarian reform. The film was banned. 3 years later, Amirale made The Chickens, a critical look at the government's clumsy efforts to stimulate private industry. He focused on a village where the peasants agreed to put everything they owned into the poultry business, even turning their houses into chicken coops. A plague among the chickens forced the villagers into bankruptcy, but they continued to pursue their ill-advised investment. At the end of the film, the clucking of chickens drowns out the speech of the village's doomed capitalists. Amirale said of the cinema club, "We showed the kind of films we dreamed of making." Using projectors borrowed from the Soviet Cultural Center, the club members set up a screening room on the ground floor of an apartment building. The room, which faced a garden, was too cramped for the film to be projected in front of the screen, so they turned to Nazi Shabandar, an elderly man who had pioneered movie projection in Syria by making all the equipment himself. Shabandar set up the projector in an adjoining kitchen and projected the image onto a mirror in the garden, which reflected it onto the rear of the screen. In that manner, the cinema club presented the works of Bergman, Fellini, and Godard, along with a handful of Syrian films. The screenings were followed by impassioned debates, which provided a safe way to discuss the filmmaker's larger predicament. Club members held screenwriting seminars and technical workshops and published a magazine, Film. The French comic actor and director Jacques Tati visited the club, and the Italian writer and director Pier Paolo Pasolini came to speak when he was shooting Medea in Aleppo. In 1978, in conjunction with the French journal Cahiers du Cinéma, the club sponsored 2 weeks of cinema and politics. There were two screenings a day. "We sold out every performance," Amirale recalled. The critics of Cahiers du Cinéma had chosen 18 films, but when the Syrian government banned more than half of them, the French critic Serge Danet sat on the stage and provided an imaginative narration of what the films would have shown. It was a screening without an image. "An absolutely beautiful happening," Amirale said. In 1980, Hafez al-Assad began a series of mass arrests in an attempt to eliminate dissent altogether. Hundreds of dissidents were imprisoned and tortured. When Amirale discovered that his name was on a list of people to be arrested, he moved to France. Most of the filmmakers who worked for the government, however, stayed and tried to practice their craft in a society that was cowed and broken. Ferris Helou is one of Syria's biggest movie and television stars. He is a burly man with tightly curled hair and a heavy, expressive face, and his gentle humor on screen reminded me of Jack Lemmon. Helou is also known for declaring his negative views of the regime. "I'm loved as an actor, so I'm protected," he said one afternoon at the Rauda Cafe. Indeed, as we talked, fans approached him for autographs and snapshots, but his friends worried that Helou's career had been damaged by his political stance. "His starometer is going down," one of them told me. "People are afraid to work with him. Maybe he's not as protected as he thinks he is." Helou fell in love with cinema while studying at Syria's Higher Institute for Theater Arts. Soon after graduating, he got a role in Mohamed Malice's second feature film, The Night, 1993. Subsequent television roles have made him known throughout the Arab world. Syrian miniseries are ubiquitous on Arab satellite television. I asked him if things had changed in Syria since the ascent to power of Bashar al-Assad, who had presented himself to the West as a reformer. "We had the same amount of freedom, or more, in Hafez's time," Helou said. "Hafez, at least, was clear. With any position, you knew exactly the space that was allowed. But after the sun came in, the freedom given us was not real. It was a trap. When voices started to be heard presenting new and modern ideas, the regime arrested those voices. As Helou and I were talking, a young fan in a jean jacket and a checked shirt approached the table. "I love you," he said to Helou in Arabic. "I just want to exchange mobile numbers. I promise I won't abuse it." To my surprise, Helou offered his number. "What's your name?" he asked the fan. "My friends call me Stalin," he said, "because I'm a killer." Stalin had broad shoulders, a long, unbroken eyebrow that stretched across his forehead, and a gold chain around his neck. Helou gave a dismissive nod, and Stalin retreated to his table. I asked Helou about Osama Mohammed's second film, Sacrifices. Helou plays a father who leaves Syria to fight in the 1973 war against Israel. When he returns home to his family on a remote mountaintop, he is caked with mud. In a savagely ironic scene, he gathers the family to tell his story. The women are beating cotton balls on the table, and a cow stands at the front door. Helou's character explains that he was nearly killed when he was buried by an explosion. It took 3 days for his fellow Arabs to get a bulldozer to dig him out. "There was no fuel left, it seems," the character says bitterly. Where was the Arabs' oil when it was needed, he wonders. Helou said of his character, "The shock of being defeated makes him cruel. Embracing the illusion of authority makes him think he was victorious." But, as the film shows, the only legacy of violence is more violence. Helou's character eventually abuses power in the same way as the corrupt and incompetent state that sent him into the disastrous war. When he comes home, he forces his children to drink oil. Stalin suddenly returned to our table. "I have another phone," he said to Helou, switching to English for my benefit. "I want to give you the number. Very few people have this. I even take it with me on operations." He was making it clear that he was with the secret police. "Is this the first time you've been in this cafe?" Helou asked him. "No, I'm always here," Stalin said. "We have spoken before. Usually I'm dressed in a military uniform, so perhaps you don't recognize me." Stalin asked if Helou was a member of the Ba'ath Party. Helou said he was not. "You cannot not be a member," Stalin said angrily, grabbing Helou's hand. "This is a real Ba'athist handshake. I will pay your dues for you." Stalin noticed that I was taking notes on his conversation, and he began expatiating on American and British aggression in Iraq and the interference of human rights activists in Syrian affairs. "We should be able to discipline the peasants without outside interference," he said. "I quote Aristotle to his student Alexander the Great, who said that you should treat the Greek people as gentlemen and the people of the East as slaves." With that, Stalin returned to his table once again. "He came to deliver a message," Helou said anxiously. "He's telling me to take it easy, to calm down." His left leg was jiggling furiously. Minutes later, Stalin returned yet again, this time carrying a cup of coffee and a pack of Gitan. He had no intention of letting my interview continue. Bizarrely, he pulled yet another telephone from a jacket pocket. "This is my most private number," he said to Helou. He pointed to an arrow on the phone's screen beside Helou's mobile number. "This arrow goes through you," he said, laughing. He squeezed in next to Helou, who had become quiet. "Do you work for the government?" I asked Stalin. Of course, that's why I'm talking to you, he said. But I am very open. I am not a spy. Do you say spy or spy?
Spy.
Stalin said that, like me, he was also a journalist, working for a pro-government magazine. He added that he loved movies.
Syrian movies, he said. I love the movies that are produced by the National Film Organization and the movies made by this man, regardless of the fact that he is not obedient.
Stalin took Helu's hand once more.
I feel the need to beat someone, he said, laughing into Helu's shoulder. May I beat you?
I could see that Helu was ready to get out of there.
Welcome to Syria, Stalin said as we left.
Meet me in Saleh Square in 10 minutes, Orwa Nirabia, a young Syrian filmmaker, said when I called him one afternoon to ask about the market in pirated DVD movies. A bronze soldier stands in the center of the square atop a column. An actual Syrian flag flaps against his scabbard. It's Yusuf Azmi, Nirabia explained. He was the Minister of Defense when the French army invaded in 1921. He and a group of 500 riflemen went to meet them because they didn't want to see the country occupied without any resistance. There wasn't a single survivor among them. I love this story. This could be a huge, epic film. Nirabia told me he intended to be Syria's first independent producer. Digital equipment has reduced the cost of making films, and satellite television has created a potentially huge market for Arab cinema. He thought it could soon be possible for Syrian directors to create work without government funding, though scripts will still require approval by the General Institute of Cinema. Nirabia is a big man with a goatee and close-cropped hair that makes his expressive face all the more imposing. We walked to Media Mart, a store by the square, which had a vast selection of pirated DVDs and computer software. In 2004, President George W. Bush placed Syria under an embargo of American goods, except for food and medicine, because of the country's continued support of terrorism and its failure to control the movement of insurgents into Iraq. Kodak film stock and chemicals were included in the embargo. It would be a problem for our industry if we actually had an industry, Nirabia told me as we wandered among the small shops. Although hardware was harder to obtain now, software has always been cheap and illegal. Piracy has been a great blessing, said Nirabia. Because of this, most members of my generation are computer literate. For his business, however, he had decided to pay the market rate for software in order to avoid problems with compatibility. A lot of guys would laugh at me, he said, noting that professional film editing software costs several $1,000s in the West. But you can buy it in the Damascus market for 20. The Media Mart was crammed with recent movies, such as Capote and Sin City. Nirabia recalled, when I was a kid, they had VHS rental stores, but everything was censored. They were all stamped by the Ministry of Culture. Now, nothing is censored. Only pornography and banned Syrian movies were absent from the shelves. The Assad government has apparently decided that it can placate its citizens by allowing thousands of American films to circulate, as long as they aren't watched in large groups. As Nirabia explained, the regime has decided, let's encourage people to stay home, it's safer. Nirabia purchased March of the Penguins, and at my suggestion, the Mike Nichols production of Angels in America. We wandered outside, past the Cham Palace, to a coffee house named Aroma, which faces the grounds of the Parliament building. The flat roofs of the nearby apartments were topped with satellite dishes pointed west, like flowers inclining toward the afternoon sun. Nurabia was telling me about a script he had just submitted for review to a committee of the General Institute that he hoped to direct himself. It's about a family, husband and wife and child, and they pass a shop, Nurabia said. We just see the husband's eyes glance at a brown suit. The wife catches this and asks him, "Should we go in? That suit would look beautiful on you." But he declines. He's in a hurry. "Every week we are always the first ones to arrive at your mother's house," she says. "Take 20 minutes for yourself." But still, he declines. While they are arguing, their child runs away. But it's about the relationship of the man and the woman. And you tell everything just in the glances and the way they react to each other.
What did the committee say?
They didn't get it. They wanted it to be all about the search for the child. But that would be banal. Parents looking everywhere. You know what happens already. I said that I actually agreed with the committee. His idea seemed strangely inert.
Nurabia recalled a protest he had joined in December 1990, just before the American bombing of Baghdad, when the Syrian government authorized a demonstration in front of the American embassy that got out of hand. It started out peacefully, but it became a monster, Nurabia said. The embassy was burned, along with the ambassador's residence, the American school, and the British consul. I asked him how he felt now about having been part of such a mob.
"I feel good," he said. "For the first time in my life, I was part of a violent protest, something which is normal all over the world. I believe this is the main problem in Syria. It's a very static society, so I'm happy when I see something dynamic happening. I mean, we don't even have crimes. This is not good. I might sound like an anarchist, but this even applies to the commercial film industry. Most action films in Hollywood couldn't be made here because we don't have the action to put onto film, and you are forbidden to do movies about corruption or comedies about the police or the army. Crime or horror films are also not allowed here. Where can you go to come up with a decent project to make a proper blockbuster? You need action thrillers or comedies, and we can't do either."
I pointed out that his own scenario had avoided the obvious action, the parents searching for their missing child.
"That's not forbidden, surely," I said. "Maybe it's a problem of your imagination that you don't allow yourself to think about action."
Nurabia paused.
"I don't know," he said. "Could be."
In 1992, Omar Amirallah, after making 8 films in France, came back to Syria.
"I was fed up with Paris," he said, and he sensed that he could go home without being arrested. Also, he had fallen in love with a Damascene woman.
"It was a sentimental return," he said.
But Amirallah had a score to settle, too. As a young documentarian, he had been given the chance to make a movie about the damming of the Euphrates River. The result, Film Essay on the Euphrates Dam, 1970, was heavily influenced by Soviet documentaries, with a reverent approach to the mighty instruments of labor. He came to see it as a naively Marxist work. "A hymn to the crane" is how he refers to it. That is wholly uncritical of the Ba'athist regime. "For me, that first film is a deep wound in my heart," Amirallah told me. "I was able to make a career outside of my homeland. I don't regret it. But if they had given me the chance to live in Syria, maybe I and my colleagues could have created a better country."
In 2003, he returned to the dam region. "I wanted to make a film of 15 shots. Which are the 15 reasons I hate the Ba'ath Party. The last reason was that I hate myself for having been obliged to make a film for them. They spoiled 40 years of my life." Flood begins with a bitter voiceover. Amirale says, "In 1970, I was a firm advocate of the modernization of my homeland, Syria, so much so that I dedicated my first film to the building of a dam in the Euphrates River, the pride and joy of the Ba'ath Party then in power. Today, I regret this error of my youth." I asked if Flood had ever been shown in Syria. Amirale shook his head. "But when I finished, I decided to give it to some film pirates," he explained. 2 months later, everybody in Damascus had seen it. It was a digital Flood. In April 2000, the filmmaker Nabil Maleh started the Committee for the Revival of Civil Society, along with a small group of lawyers and intellectuals. Decades earlier, Maleh had directed some of Syria's most insurrectionary movies, including The Leopard, 1972, a historical film about a revolt against an earlier Syrian regime. Maleh, who was born in 1936, was old enough to recall a Syria with a vigorous press and numerous political parties, as well as a vibrant civic life. Once his movement got going, allied committees began springing up all over Syria. Hafez al-Assad died that June, which increased expectations that Syria might finally open up. In September, 99 prominent Syrians, including 15 filmmakers, signed a petition calling for an end to the restrictions on freedom of assembly, opinion, and the press, a general amnesty for all political prisoners, and a decree allowing political exiles abroad to return. The regime responded by releasing 600 political prisoners. Encouraged by this, in January 2001, more than 1,000 prominent Syrians, some of them living in exile, signed a broader and more daring petition called the Basic Document, which had been drafted by Maleh's committee. The Basic Document called for an end to Ba'ath Party domination. "Immediately came the crash," Maleh recalled. Bashar al-Assad warned that the advocates of greater openness were outsiders and were undermining the stability of the country. He declared that all social, political, and cultural gatherings had to be approved in advance. A few months later, 10 signatories of the Basic Document were imprisoned for attempting to change the constitution by illegal means. Officials told Maleh that he would never be able to make films again. The government effectively smothered the reform movement, even as it maintained the appearance of liberalizing by releasing elderly political prisoners and allowing the publication of new journals with minimal political content. "The development of civil society institutions must come at a later stage," Bashar declared. "We lost the war without ever fighting it," Maleh admitted one evening at dinner in an old house in the Christian quarter of Damascus, now a lovely but generally empty restaurant. "I had suggested that political opposition in Damascus often seemed more gestural than real, and that making movies no one could see was therefore a characteristic expression of Syrian dissent. Perhaps the society was so tamed by the regime that no more could be expected of it. But it was also possible that the regime was simply the political expression of a brutal and authoritarian culture." Maleh had told me about an incident in his childhood when he was 7 years old. "I was with my family in a public park in Damascus," he recalled. "I wanted to use the swing. There were some children already playing there, and they were guarded by a soldier, probably a driver for some big shot. I don't know what I did to provoke it, but the soldier slapped me, knocking me 4 meters away. I picked up a clod of dirt, threw it at the soldier, and ran away. From that moment, all my life has been connected with a hatred of the uniform and of authority. As an adult, after a protest, Molly was taken to prison and beaten.
It was part of the fun of the times, he said, in a strangely off-kilter tone.
Before I went to Damascus, the characters in Syrian films had seemed to me full of unmotivated cruelty, but now they were beginning to make sense. In every movie I saw, physical abuse played a role, and the more I talked to the filmmakers, I realized that abuse and the consequent sense of helplessness and victimhood had shaped their lives in defining ways. This anger was palpable in Malle's films, most poignantly in The Extras, 1993, in which two lovers meet at a friend's apartment for an assignation. They suppose that they have finally shut out the world that has prevented them from consummating their relationship, but fear prevents them from enjoying their moment alone. The film gets its title from the male character who plays bit parts in theatrical productions, underscoring Malle's belief that we are all extras in this society. The real world intrudes when the secret police enter the apartment, supposedly investigating a blind musician who lives next door. The man tries to prevent the musician's arrest, and in a reverie, imagines dispatching the police with a few judo moves, but his fantasy is broken by a hard slap that knocks him to the floor. He is humiliated and powerless in front of his lover, a devastating turning point in their relationship.
They enter the apartment as lovers, Malle told me. They leave as strangers.
I thought of other scenes in Syrian cinema in which physical abuse plays a significant role. For example, in Mohammed's film Stars, a character is made permanently deaf by a blow from his father. These scenes, I knew, reflected the filmmaker's experiences. When I asked them about the abuse, however, their responses surprised me. Abdulatif Abdulhamid, whose films often feature punitive fathers, told me about going to see Hercules when he was a boy. Afterward, he ran into his family's wheat field with a stick, engaging in mock battle. When he damaged a few stalks, he said with a smile, "My father beat me." Amirale, whose father died when he was 5, said, "I was beaten only by the slippers of my mother, and for this I am grateful. Such beatings awakened me." I went to dinner one night in a restaurant with some Syrian artists, and I brought up the subject of physical abuse. "It's common," the middle-aged woman across from me acknowledged. She added, "For me, it was a positive experience."
"What do you mean?"
"I was 26 years old," she recalled. "At first, I was hurt. I was living just to please others, for example, my ex-husband and his family. Then I realized that a word from your mouth can make the difference between survival and destruction." She was staring at me. Her shining brown eyes seemed strangely untroubled. "A beating did this for you?" She nodded. "It was like a revolution. It was like you are not living anymore to please others. You suddenly become very brave. I was one step from death. But I was thinking of my children, and I was determined to survive. It was positive for me. This is when I decided to be a creative person."
"So your ex-husband hit you?"
"No," she said quietly, so the other guests wouldn't hear. She took my notepad and wrote, "Raped by the government." Later, I asked Molly if Syrian society had always been so abusive.
"No," he said. "Violence became a part of the daily practice in the last 40 years.
The Ba'athist throttling of democratic expression, he believed, replicated itself in the relationships between authority figures and people without power, women, children, and the poor. Although the filmmakers often talked about freedom, they revealed a perverse desire to romanticize the artistic constraints of dictatorship. The most beautiful Soviet films were produced in the era of Stalin, Abdulhamid told me, when the Soviet Union collapsed, and suddenly you could say whatever you wanted. The Russians began producing the most trivial films. Nobody should be forbidden to say what he wants, but it is a phenomenon that dazzles me. When you're suppressed, you think better. The Arab cinema has few masterpieces, no more than 10, Omar Amirale pronounced one afternoon over cappuccino. Among them, he included two Egyptian films, Cairo Station by Yusuf Shaheen and Fool's Alley by Tufik Saleh. Both films, he observed, were the director's first major efforts. It is a syndrome in Arab cinema that directors who make a remarkable first film rarely succeed in making another, he said. There were no Syrian films in his pantheon. I asked where he placed his friend Osama Muhammad. Osama is an exception, Amirale said, but he hasn't had the liberty to make an accomplished film, and of course he suffers from a lack of opportunity and experience. Syrian films have the potential to be great films, he continued, but they lack the dimension of unity, the compact structure, the purposeful style, the visual sensibility. Many of the actors are not sufficiently mature or experienced. I always feel there is something wrong. As if they were ordinary people who were simulating acting. And finally, the narration. We are so obsessed by daily reality that scriptwriters don't have the courage to invent new realities from their own imaginations. Because of this, I think they are making bad documentaries and passing them off as fiction. One evening I went to the old city with a Syrian cameraman, Samir Al-Zayat, for a drink at Café Marmar, in a 16th-century building with stone walls and 20-foot ceilings. We walked into a room full of upturned faces, illuminated by the familiar flickering light of a movie. I had stumbled upon the latest incarnation of the Damascus Cinema Club. I ordered popcorn and a martini. It's a very congenial club, and watched Big Fish. In attendance were many of Syria's film and television stars who apparently had enough influence to keep the underground operation alive. This is the only venue left for new artistic movies, Zayat told me. They advertise by SMS messages on the telephones and show films every Monday night. Last week, we watched Munich. Unlike the old days of the cinema club, however, the audience departed quietly when the film was over. The week after I left Syria, a government-approved newspaper announced that the following day, Osama Muhammad's sacrifices would be given its first public showing in Homs, a provincial town in central Syria. Muhammad raced to Homs, only to discover that his film was not being shown after all. Instead, a Ba'athist youth rally was underway. It was a prank. Though he knew that he wouldn't change the situation, he acted out the role of the fearless dissident. I shouted and made a scene, Muhammad told me. I said I would call the governor. I really played the game. Postscript. Many of the people I interviewed in this piece are now in exile, along with millions of other Syrians. Osama Muhammad is in Paris. Orwa Nirabia was arrested and imprisoned during the early stage of the civil war, but was freed after an international campaign on his behalf by fellow filmmakers. He now lives in Berlin. In 2013, he produced Return to Homs by Syrian director Talal Derki, a gritty portrait of the resistance inside one of the country's most battered cities. The film won the Grand Jury Prize at Sundance. Nirabia also served as a producer for Osama Muhammad's film with Wiam Simav Bedirksan, Silvered Water, Syria Self-Portrait, which premiered at the Cannes Film Festival in 2014. Nabil Maleh died in Dubai in February 2016.